is indeed to welcome Dr. Graham Schwein. I'm sure he needs no introduction. He teaches at the Christopher Newport University, where he's the director of the Indian Studies Program, and he's a professor of religious studies and philosophy. He's been doing some work on the Bhakti Sutras, and today he's going to speak on the Bhakti Sutras and the three roles of the heart. Do you want to make a connection with the Bhakti Sutras?
Yes. Yeah, sometimes sutras or sutra.
Sutra, yes.
I like sutra.
It's easy. Yes.
But then again, you see also yoga sutrani.
Yes.
So in the Sanskrit, you often will find plural.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, I never really resolve. It's a deep conflict. I don't quite yet know how to handle that.
Are we safe here?
I'm just getting away from that.
Is this all right if I go like this?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, good. As long as the fan, some fan. Oh, here it is. Here are the fan actions right here. Yeah, as long as you're good.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. This is great, and it works out for my itinerary back around from Sweden. So, and that's when I emailed you, Gavin, when I said, oh, I've got a date. Here's the Sardella defense.
Oh.
So, yes, and he does send his regards to everyone and is a very happy man now that he has indeed survived the opponent, Julius Leibniz.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and his defense. That's great. It was very well done. He did a very good job. I'm nowhere near doing as good a job as Ferdinando did, because my work is hardly done. But it's in process. So this is a work in process, and I'm here basically to, well, experiment with all of you today. Sounds a little scary, but it's really, you'll be all right. You're fairly safe. But yes, my title, Three Worlds of the Heart, Theological and Literary Dimensions of the Bhakti Sutra. What I've been, this is such a strange sort of text, and it's a delightful text. Interesting that Julius and I talked and had dinner several times during the Sardella event, because he gave me a copy of his second edition of his book for religion, the Hindus.
Quite
right?
Different, isn't it?
It's greatly expanded. It's quite expanded, and he's. I was surprised to see, and delighted to see that in his conclusion, he has taken the sort of climactic text of the Bhakti Sutra to express something of a kind of pan-Indian phenomenon. Very interesting. And I'm going to return to that and perhaps why he could do that. Because one of my questions here is, you know, why, you know, was the Bhakti Sutra written? If we accept the date, the fairly accepted date of around the 11th and 12th century in the form that we have it today. As we all know, that was the start of what we often call the Bhakti Renaissance. So here was a time when the Bhakti, that meta thought was occurring with Bhakti. Ramanuja writing his Sri Bhashya. Bhakti was now starting to take on philosophical articulations and explications. And so, you know, if we situate the Bhakti Sutra within that point of history, it's a kind of strange thing to know that there are no traditional commentaries to this text. Bodleian has nothing. Everyone I've asked in India, I did research in India, there are no commentaries. I thought there would be at least, you know, one or two. Vallabha mentions the Bhakti Sutra maybe a few times in passing, but nothing very serious. So here's a text that presumably was around for, you know, at least several centuries of philosophizing about Bhakti, theologizing about Bhakti, but yet we have no commentary. It was only in the 20th century, which I know is long ago for all of us, except for me. Maybe you, Gavin, as well. But anyway, but as long ago, But it's only in the 20th century that suddenly there is this flowering of interest in the Bhakti Sutra. You have several earlier 20th century Indian and Western scholars publishing it, sacred books of the Hindus. You've got even more recent translations of it. Recently, very recently, 2008 maybe, Daniel Sheridan. Have you got that book here? It's a comparison. It's sort of a comparative study of Catholic theology and the Bhakti Sutra. It's very interesting. This just came fairly. I have it, I think, somewhere in my bags. But so, there, suddenly in the 20th century, in India and in the West, there's now this interest. Why? I'm really trying to understand this. And here I am, sort of left stranded, you know, without a commentary, without any traditional commentaries. After, of course, translating the Rasalila Panchadhyayi, where I spent, I have about 3,000 pages of translation of commentary, so I was over-commentaried with that text. And here I'm now standing here, sort of alone, in a sense, with the text. So, I guess what... Oh, that's the description for today's talk. Let's ignore it, because really we don't know if anything's going to come true with that. This is supposed to be published by Columbia University Press. The poor editor there has absolutely no idea when I'll submit it. It's been years overdue, but that apparently is not uncommon for our colleagues. A lot of us are overdue. Okay. So, one of the things, before I get to this particular slide, I guess my thesis could be summarized by saying that this text is the Bhakti Sutra. And I'm stating the obvious here. That's what it's called. It's often called the Narada Bhakti Sutra, or the Bhakti Sutra of Narada, which I prefer. But I'm not just taking the title as a Tatpurush compound, a sutra on bhakti, which is the way it would typically be taken. But I'm also taking it as a Karmadharya compound, which would translate it as, it's very much a bhakti sutra, a sutra that is very bhakti-ish. Okay? And that's really my thesis, that it's not just a sutra on bhakti, but the sutra text itself is doing bhakti. Moving along with this, number four, it has teachings that are expressive in and of itself of bhakti in the way that it's presented within the sutra genre. What you'll hear me talking about today is that the sutra text is it's pushing the genre beyond what one would normally expect of a sutra text. It's very expressive. I'll show you different ways that it's expressive. It's a departure from the normal sutra text that we would expect, say, for example, in the Brahma Sutra or the Vedanta Sutra, or, for example, in the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. And I've done some comparisons. But here, I'll also, just in terms of the authorship, it's authoritative. The teachings are authoritative in the sense of presenting it itself in the sutra genre, and this is one way to impute greater authority to a teaching, and certainly bhakti during this period was getting that authoritative surge in the different works of the bhakti acharyas. But then also in authorship, we say it's the author Narada, but we're going to take a look at that, because I think it's much more than Narada. And of course, in one sense, the Yoga Sutra is Patanjali's, but obviously every sutra text is much more than the purported author, because it's bringing together, synthesizing teachings that came beforehand. But here it's doing more with the authorship as well. So we're going to look at that. It's also an informative. The teachings are informative theologically. It's a very theological text. You know, this text doesn't really hassle much with issues of, you know, the tensions of karma, you know, karma and jnana, and so on, and situating itself there. It has a couple of sutra texts and pretty much dismisses those other paths and says that, well, bhakti has all that in it, so let's just keep focusing on bhakti. So it's a very concise text. It doesn't have a lot of room for a lot of argument. As far as I know, it's the shortest sutra text on the market, so to speak. 84 aphorisms, as opposed to 196 in the Yoga Sutra, as opposed to 554 for the Vedanta Sutra. So it's a very short text. So how much can you get done in 84 texts? I mean, even speaking to my daughter, who tends to be rather short on the phone, is longer than 84 aphorisms, for heaven's sake. And she's really, concise, shall we say. So the author here must have learned from my daughter or something, is one of my conclusions of today.
Okay.
So, and then, of course, it's also a didactic text. It's very didactic. But when I say very, I mean, again, how much room is there for instruction, right? How much room? 84 little aphorisms. A gerbil could talk more than that. I mean, there's hardly any room for much instruction, and yet it is, in its own way, powerfully instructive. Because there are so few sutra texts, each one becomes that much more valuable. It becomes, you don't have much to work with, so everything you've got there becomes extremely valuable. Whereas, 554 sutra texts, I mean, what the heck, you can give or take some, throw some out or whatever. But here they all seem to be very tightly dependent, interdependent. So basically, the teachings of the Bhakti Sutra are authoritative, they're informative, theologically, they're instructive, and they're very expressive. And I think this is what I'm trying to bring out in a translation of this text. Okay, so my talk is sort of going to generally follow. Now, one of the things I like to do in my own translation work is I like to present very carefully crafted translations. Ones that kind of parallel the ordering of the Sanskrit words. And all of you know that Sanskrit's a highly inflected language, and the ordering, in one sense, in Sanskrit is not critical. But the ordering that's there is significant because that's the way the Sanskrit ear hears it. And so with a text like this, which takes on, in a way, certain poetic qualities that other sutra texts may not quite, because of its infusion of bhakti expression, I take these little aphorisms, in a sense, almost poetically, and you'll see why. I mean, it is not poetry. It isn't poetry in the classical Sanskrit sense. It is not. There's no verse here. These are, aphorisms, terse aphorisms. But they're not so terse as the Yoga Sutra or the Vedanta Sutra. Okay? Or for that matter, the Shandilya Bhakti Sutra. Okay? This first text, oh my gosh, I could go on and on about this, but I have to be very restrained here. Atato, of course, this is the very typical way a sutra text begins. Ata, now. Okay. The question really becomes, what now means. I think in this text, it means all kinds of things, and I've got already, I think, 10 pages on this word now, which is ridiculous, and I'm going to have to shorten that. I don't want this book to be another 400-page book, Publishers don't like that these days. So, now, I think most poignantly here means, now that we've... This is Bhakti India speaking. Okay, I'm the voice of Bhakti India for the moment, okay? If you'll indulge me, Shanika, on that. Okay. So, now that we have been delighting in the Ramayana, for hundreds of years, the Bhagavata Purana, Mahabharata, all these leelas, all this infusion, and now that we've been singing the praises of Vishnu and Shiv, the Nayanars, the Alvars. I mean, now that all this activity has been going on, it's time for a Vyakhyasyamaha. Okay? It's time that we now expound. This is not just a Kyasyamaha. This is Vyakhyasyamaha. So there's extra emphasis on not just speaking about, but expounding upon. To me, this is really moving us to the idea of a theology, a careful explication of what is going on in bhakti and in bhakti experience. So I don't take words lightly, and here there's no attempt to fill a meter length or anything like that, which sometimes scholars will say. I don't always really believe that, but the author did not have to say Vyakhyasyamaha, okay? So as you know, the prefix vi means wide, very spread. So I mean, it seeks to do something comprehensive and thorough in these 84 little aphorisms. Furthermore, in the very last, sutra text, in a way it takes on a mandala shape. It's circular, and so the beginning, in some sense, kind of meets the ending, like a necklace, right? I mean, you got to connect it somewhere, right? So this is the little connector, and here the main thing I want to bring to your attention. First are the words Narada proktam. So Narada spoke this. We don't have anything here about his writing it. And what I've taken some time to explain is that these words will quote Narada earlier on in the text in the third person. You don't get the feeling that he's the author. He may have spoken them, but I'm making a distinction between speaking it and writing it. You get the sense that there's a third party, sort of surreptitiously, writing down all this stuff, not just from Narada, but from other teachers. And in the penultimate aphorism, there's a list of great teachers of bhakti, I think 13 of them. So there's a sense of an aggregate voice that Narada speaks that someone else is writing down. And what this gives the reader a very strong sense of the bhakti community, bhakti as community. It's a faith of bhaktas, of a sharing between bhaktas, comes across through this text rather powerfully, and in ways we have yet to see. So again, I'm going to try to move through quickly here. We can go into some details here. So if we take, I didn't even explain. Let's go back. Shivanushasanam. Hear the word anushasanam. It's not just a shasanam, a teaching, but an anushasanam. This again implies, and I use the word systematic, a systematic teaching. And it's interesting, the way this text ends is the way that the Yoga Sutra begins, atha yoganushasanam. So the Yoga Sutra is an anushasanam. This is an anushasanam according to this author, but it's not just an anushasanam. It's not just a shasanam, it's an anushasanam, but it's also a shivanushasanam, an auspicious teaching. And why is it auspicious? Because it's now, going back to the atha, now that we've had all these incredible narratives and Puranic and epic presentations of bhakti, and the Bhagavad Gita, the first real philosophizing of bhakti, now, perhaps, before, Ramanuja goes too much further, perhaps Madhva comes along, perhaps before, Nimbarka, perhaps before Chaitanya and his teachers, now is the time maybe to explicate this in some theological terms. And I think that's what this author is trying to do. One who, from these words spoken by Narada, constituting this auspicious systematic teaching, draws one's very breath from it, Vishwasati, who has faith in it, Shraddhate. That person becomes filled with the offerings of all one's heart to the beloved in bhakti. The way I translate bhakti, which, you know, how do you translate it? This is such a rich term. But because this whole text has the object of bhakti in mind, or I should say the subject of bhakti is implied in every aphorism, I have this protracted translation of the offering of all one's heart. And again, this goes back to this idea of sharing. And sharing not just with Bhagavan, but sharing among bhaktas as well. So there are really two kinds of sharing. Sharing with the divine, sharing with the devotee, or among devotees. Okay, so my claim is that this sutra is really doing theology. Maybe in some seed-like form, but after all, that's what a sutra does, right? Sutra is there for the teacher to come along and expound on it. Even though we have no commentaries, I'm sure that there were some bhakti teachers who used it to expound on their teachings to their students. But I will again get to why I think there are no commentaries. Okay, I want to leave that kind of mysterious. Keep all of you on the edge of your seats like an exciting mystery. You know, like one of those mystery novels, you know? Do you know what I'm saying? Maybe not. Maybe Oxford doesn't have any of those things. But that's fine.
Oh, you have
lots of mystery here. Right, okay, good. Yes, I've understood that from Shonika, yes. So here, I have, because the text told me it's an anushasana, because the text told me that they're going to, that these voices are going to expound upon bhakti, there are no divisions within the original text that I know of. Okay. So I found my own divisions that I've observed and subdivisions of these divisions. So it's very simple. The nature of bhakti, practice of bhakti, perfection, I'm not sure I like the word perfection, but or the purity of bhakti, or whatever. And then finally a kind of closing the sutra texts, the blessings of bhakti. And they fall fairly neatly within these, but I think they fall even neater within the more broken down subsections. I'm not going to, in my presentation of the text and publication, I'm not going to, as some colleagues will do, impose on the reader my subsections and subsections. That I'll do in my discussion area. I want them to read the text as it comes. But I won't hesitate to present my divisions and subdivisions as you see here. So when you look at them all together, it's interesting how the text begins rather powerfully with some sort of, you could say, some kind of bija text. And of course, the first one we've already read, the sutra subject and authorial voice, the essential elements of bhakti in 2 and 3. I take these as really the bija of the whole text. The experiences in bhakti, renunciation and exclusivity in bhakti, different characteristics of bhakti, the selfless love of the Vrajagopikas. That last subsection is really astonishing because there is no mention of any example of a bhakta in the whole text until you get to the penultimate aphorism in which you find bhakti teachers, the bhaktiacharyas, they're called, the bhaktiacharyas, who speak with a unified voice. So they're the ones who are speaking this in some sense. But the Vrajagopikas are given as the example. 4 sutra texts out of the 84 are focused on the Vrajagopikas. Well, this is, you know, very powerful. This is a very powerful statement. We'll maybe come back to that. No guarantees, depending on time. The practice of bhakti. All perfections contained in bhakti. Bhakti is both the means and the end. That's quite a large section, 28 to 33. I mean, you know, again, these are large sections when you go 5 or over, because, again, there's just so many texts to go around. The discipline of bhakti, the grace of divinity and devotees. Interestingly here, the role of a guru or an acharya is hardly emphasized in this literature, like you find it in sectarian bhakti traditions. You have great devotees are really not quite the right term, great ones, mahantas, great ones, great saint, in a more colloquial English, saintly persons, great ones. That kind of person is what the text is to whom the text is referring for grace, both the divine, the divinity, and great bhaktas. It's interesting. It's not singling out a guru or a particular kind of guru and so on, but great bhaktas and the divine. Speaking of not singling out, even divinity, there is not one proper name for the divine in the whole of the 84 aphorisms. So there's no mention of Krishna, there's no mention of Shiva, there's no mention of Vishnu. There is a mention of Vishnu, I'll contradict myself. In the penultimate text, he's included with other great bhakti-acharyas. So it doesn't count. He's just one among many bhakti-acharyas. He's not identified as the beloved. And most of the time, throughout the aphorisms, the divinity is referred to by an impersonal pronoun, tat. That one. So there's a kind of openness to who that divinity is. The power of social connections and practice of transcendence. By the way, if anyone has any questions while I'm moving along, just, you know, blurt it out. And if I don't seem to hear you, then you can throw something at me. Soft. Something soft. The perfection of bhakti. Then here this divides up the nature of pure love, stages of bhakti, bhakti as the greatest process, conducive behavior for bhakti, the signs and effects of pure bhakti, prescriptions for saintly behavior. So in giving you these, I think that you're getting a pretty good idea of the sort of things that the Bhakti Sutra talks about, those of you who are not familiar with it, and also how it sort of divides up and how it sort of develops its explication. And then finally, notice how the text sort of tapers down.
What just made you put number one in that last section at the beginning of that section?
I'm not sure. I'm back further?
The section before.
Okay, am I on the right slide for you?
Yeah, part the name is part two.
Yes, part two. Right.
No, I'm thinking of part one, the nature.
Right.
So the first group of verses in part three.
Oh, I see. In other words, I'm repeating that. Mm-hmm. Right.
Is there something that let me see. Pick up previous sections before you go on?
Okay, essential elements of bhakti. Is that what you're equating with the nature of bhakti?
No, with the whole of the theme.
Oh, I see the whole of the. I see what you're saying. Yes. That's yes. That's probably not a good. That's good. Well, the nature of pure bhakti is what I say here, right? So that would be the difference. Yes, and you know what the word is. Maybe I should just come out and just use the word prema. That is the nature of pure love is prema. And that's what might be better, a little less risky for equating the two as you've done, but it's a little different. Yeah, the nature of pure love, and that would be referring to prema. Stages of bhakti. Here we're talking about bhakti as something that can be eclipsed a bit by the gunas, trigunya. So tamas, rajas, and sattva, that bhakti can be influenced by the worldly energies and not be pure. And so bhakti, in some sense, is a kind of, it's the whole process about which we've been speaking, but it's also the outer process that I'll claim here. It's the outer process. The inner process the inner world of bhakti, and again, this speaks to my title, The Three Worlds of the Heart. The outer world is something that the bhakta has to contend with. How do you practice bhakti in the outer world? Well, at first it's going to be tainted, you know, by the gunas. But it can be pure, and when it's pure, it purifies the forefathers, and it purifies the whole world. So it's very powerful when it's pure. When it's not pure, it's not so powerful. It may purify one of your forefathers, or I don't know. Not so powerful, but it's something that is not yet, in some sense, blossomed into that pure prema. So prema would be the inner world of the bhakta. The outer world, bhakti, can be pure or perhaps in a more practicing mode. But the inner world of the bhakta is prema, it's purest love, and the innermost world of the of bhakti is asakti or rasa. And that comes at the end. So you've really got these three concentric circles, you might. In fact, I think I've drawn it out, haven't I? I think it comes up. In any case, we'll get to that. But the text really moves the reader from bhakti, its practice, and its purity, to the achievement of prema, its inner world, and then from prema to rasa. That is to say, these deepest feelings in connection with the divine, in relationship to the divine. So here at the end, there are just a few texts, worship, praise, and the value of bhakti, 11 types of loving attachment. That is where the rasas are anticipated. And here I will be giving you a chart. Let me see, does that come up? Why is that there? Yeah. Sean, do you have any ideas on this one? Okay, forget it. Oh, I know why I did this, but let's skip these for right now. We can come back to these, okay? Just stick with me here. Oh, that's the penultimate one with all the... You see how Vishnu is listed there? Is he there? Yeah, there he is. Right there in the smack in the middle, right there, okay? He's one of the Bhakti Acharyas. Thus, so in this way, they speak without fear of people's useless chatter. Oh, I love that phrase. Jana Jalpa Nirbhaya. Without fear of people's useless chatter, for they are single-minded. And then the list is given, and Vishnu is right in there. So, again, no divine personage is singled out as such, or manifestation of the divine. But what are all these doing? Oh, okay, no, wait, okay, here. Okay, I'm a little jumbled here. Something's coming that I want to get to, but that'll come when I get to it. That makes sense, good sense, yeah. Okay, good. What I want to do here is I want to show you some of the features, as promised in the lecture description, some of the features that really are a departure from your typical sutra texts. I thought this would be interesting. Repetition of three identical verbs. Look at this. Yal labdwa puman siddho bhavati amrito bhavati tripto bhavati. Now, in my translation, you know, typically when you translate in English, you just get rid of the other two bhavatis and just translate the first one, you know, which upon attaining a person becomes fulfilled, immortal, and pleased. But you're depriving the English reader of this powerful, kind of forceful, and very expressive repetition. There's a drama to it. Which upon attaining a person becomes fulfilled, one becomes immortal, one becomes pleased. So, this is one sort of literary sort of technique of the sutra. Here again, which upon knowing one becomes overjoyed, one becomes unwavering, one becomes delighted within oneself. Now, just taking this, I'm going to digress slightly, quickly. Take a look at these three things that one becomes once knowing bhakti. One becomes overjoyed. This I identify with the outer world of bhakti. In the outer world, when a bhakta has become filled with bhakti, one becomes overjoyed. It's sort of an extroversion bhakti. Unwavering, that's an inner strength. That's where one is strong in prema. And then one becomes delighted. This is innermost in rasa. So these three are nicely but sort of tacitly indicated in these three stages. And again, I think this is why bhavati is repeated several times, because of the distinctive stages and layers that the sutra text is very conscious of.
What's the implication of unwavering?
Unwavering? Stubda.
Like the stitcher at the back of the feet. I know it's a different word.
Yeah. Stubda. It also, you know, stubda is also a word used by later bhakti theologians as a kind of a sign of ecstasy. One becomes stunned. I almost used the word stunned there. One becomes sort of like just stunned. Stubda. It's almost a cognate. Stunned. Still. Fixed. Unwavering. Again, I would love to give a gloss of 50 words for that, but, you know, your translations don't really...
Stunned fits to me.
You like stunned, Beth?
Sort of word.
Oh, is that right? Okay, yeah, yeah. Overjoyed, stunned, and delighted. Yeah, yeah.
Because unwavering is...
Yeah, I had stunned at first. Yeah, you don't like that?
It's too equanimity. Yeah. It doesn't then go with ecstasy.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think...
You need something that's more emotional.
Yeah, I think I fell out of the zone when I corrected my own... Better translation. Yeah, I think I agree with you. I agree with you. Great. I'll give you credit for that. No, I'm kidding. But yes, I think so, because there's a sense of I was concerned that stunned might be too outward, but yes, stunned, you know, inwardly stunned, and then delighted, referring to, of course, the delighted within oneself, atmarana. Right. So again, the repetitions are powerful. You'll also find three different verbs in a text. Now, you know, a lot of times sutra texts don't use verbs at all. It's the implied, you know, copulative. So, you know, here, again, you've got modante pitaro nirtyanti devata sanata cheyam bhurbhavati. The forefathers, they rejoice. The divinities, they dance. And with these bhaktas, who with their Lord make this whole world come alive. So, again, I mean, how very expressive. And again, I think verging on the poetic. I don't know, Gavin, if you would agree with me on this, but I think there's a kind of poetic quality that it begs for a little bit of poetic attention, I think, in the translation. It just has that rhythm to it, and there's a kind of internal poetry to it. Here's another: several verbs and repeated words or phrases. And again, I give other aphorisms reference there. We don't obviously have time to go into all of them, but prema, having been attained, one sees before one's eyes only that one beloved, one hears only of the beloved, one thinks only of the beloved. So again, and you know, tad eva is repeated there three times. Tad eva, tad eva, tad eva. Again, this rhythm of repetition, and even tat in the beginning, referring to the divine or to the beloved. So again, you have really different internal structure to these aphorisms than you would expect. Text as only repetition of phrase. So here, this... Tadeva sadhyatam. Tadeva sadhyatam. The only time this really appears in the Vedanta Sutras, the very last sutra text, which tells you, I mean, that's about as dramatic as the Vedanta Sutra gets, right? What is it? Anavrati shabdat. Anavrati shabdat, right? So, you know, on account of shabda, one does not return. You know, one no longer... You know, engage one no longer returns to the cycle of birth and rebirth. Very powerful, you know, very powerful that there should be a repeated phrase at the very last aphorism of the Vedanta Sutra. Very powerful. Here, this text just, you know, just throws them around like crazy. And it's the text is dancing with these repetitions in all kinds of different formulations. So here is one text that repeats only the phrase. And there are several such texts like this. Then we move into texts as listings. I mean, there are several texts that do this, as I list them underneath there, 5, 72, 78, so on. The biggest one will be 82, which are the 11 types of rasas, or asaktis, that you find in the text. So, again, you know, you have this listing of qualities. Okay, because we're running out of time here, I wanted to get to this. The asakti, what did I call this? Asakti comparison chart? Okay, that sounds interesting. Anyway, this is just for our talk here. What I've tried to do here is, on the left, of course, the Bhakti Sutra, in this anti-penultimate aphorism, the 82nd aphorism of 84, has this, is the largest one. It brings out 11 rasas, if you will. Now remember, this is in the 11th or 12th century. This is before Rupa Goswami came along. And actually, you know, I would have liked Jessica to see this this slide, you know. But
can I fetch her?
No, don't fetch her. She's unfetchable right now. Yeah, she's unfetchable. Yeah. No, she's unfetchable entirely. Yeah. But, okay, before the Bhakti Sutra, we had the Bhagavata, right? And the Bhagavata, you know, in the famous verse in the seventh book, gives the nine practices, right? Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam. Of course, it's Vishnu Smaranam, but anyway, Smaranam, Archanam, Vandanam, Padasevanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam. Okay. What I've done is, and again, this is not a strict identifying one with the other, but there's a general character that I really feel is happening in all three lists. And the Chaitanya school, of course, is occurring after this text. Now, what we have in the Bhakti Sutra, I feel, is something akin to the Shanta, or reverential rasa, in the first four described. The guna mahatmya asakti, right? The rupa sakti, puja sakti, and the smaranama sakti. Okay? And so what you've got there are the more reverential, it can mean something slightly different in the Chaitanya school, more passive. There's a slightly more passive quality to Shanta, I think, in the Chaitanya school. But basically, the idea here is that when you go down either any of these lists, either any of the three of these lists, there's a greater sense of intensity and intimacy in the rasa, and that's the main point. The way they all agree is that there's greater intensity and intimacy, and they ultimately move to, of course, Sringara rasa. Even in Atmanivedanam, where one is totally offering one's whole self to the divine, it would include the Vatsalya and Sringara, as I've indicated there. And then, of course, the last four listed on the Bhakti Sutra side really talk about an interesting weaving of two dynamics, which I'll explain in the next slide. But again, the Sringara rasa, the dynamics involved in the Sringara rasa. So I find this very interesting, because there's a kind of agreement in a general sense within the theologies prior to the Bhakti Sutra and after the Bhakti Sutra. And so I'm relating them here, and of course there's much more that we could say, but I want to leave some time for any comments or questions. Okay, here I do something a little bizarre. Yeah. Should I go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can't find evidence of that, though. One would think, if they did, then, see, I feel the Chaitanya school, this is a very interesting point, I feel the Chaitanya school is more influenced by Bharata and the Natya Shastra than its own bhakti antecedents in some ways. At least Rupa. I feel he really goes more to Bharata and Natya Shastra than to... this is a very colorful list in the Bhakti Sutra. I don't quite get all the color of this list in Rupa Goswami. For example...
But, I mean, the one you have here for Chaitanya School is a very very simple presentation, but if you look at the Bhakti Rasa Nitya,
right. Well, it's very elaborate, of course.
It becomes very elaborate.
Right, right.
So there's color there, but the elaboration of color would certainly conform to everything that we see in the Bhakti Sutra.
Would it though? Because you see here, now look at one of them, for example, worship, puja. Mm-hmm. You know, that sounds like it would go something more in the dasya maybe, or I'm not sure where worship fits in.
But because that was the other question I had. On the other side we have, we're all connected, Shravan, Kirtan, Smaran, Marjan, but Smaran, for instance, is used in the Chaitanya school for meditation.
Right.
So meditation on pastimes,
right,
which would in itself be a lot more
active. Right, exactly. Exactly. Leela Smarna. Right, Leela Smarna.
And the Kirtan.
Exactly, exactly. So you see, it's not a real clean list. I think where these can begin, like Smarna, can begin early on in bhakti practice, but then carries into bhakti practice very, very deeply, potentially. And I think that's the way that these lists were intended. Because, I mean, think about the reversals in Krishna Leela that Rupa Goswami talks about. For example, the gopis, who are like the height of Sringara, right? They're jealous of Krishna's flute, which is Shanta. So, you see, it's sort of... So, I mean, that's no ordinary Shanta. We all agree. I mean, so... I mean, for the gopis to be jealous of anything, that's not ordinary anything, right? According to the theology. So Shanta suddenly takes on a new status. Smarnam would take on a new status. Kirtanam would take on a new status. But I think it's a question of where it begins within the bhakti process, I think, is what this is about. So, for example, puja can be so intimately connected in one's seva and rasa, the one's bhava, and so on. But I think it can begin early on. I think that's the idea. It can begin, I think, where it can show up. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's the only way I can kind of understand this. But you're absolutely right, Sean. I mean, my gosh, I mean, these five rasas, yeah, they're the simplest of the lists, but they're extremely elaborately described, and the nuances, and of course it's carried further with Jiva Goswami and the Bhakti Sandarbha and Preeti Sandarbha. So, yes. Well, I was thinking of putting, you know, all of Rupa's and Jiva's thought right on this slide, but it would be like in like 6-point type, and you would all have to go up to the screen to read it. So I didn't want you to strain your eyes. I find fascinating, though, again, because the Bhakti Sutra has so little time to explicate things, I find it fascinating. And here I do something a little wild, but you know, when I come here, I always do things that are a little wild, okay? Atmanepada bhakti and parasmaipada bhakti. I'm using grammatical terms here. I'm wondering if it works. But atmanepada, so for those of you who don't work with Sanskrit, atmanepada is the form of the verb, it's a mood of the verb, meaning an action that benefits oneself or that has to do with oneself. It's a bit of a reflexive. How would you describe that, Gavin? Is that right?
Yeah,
work
for oneself. Yeah.
An action kind of benefiting, in some sense, oneself, moving toward the Atma, the self. Okay. Yeah. So, and then parasmaipada would be for the benefit utterly for the other, right? For the other, para, for the other. Parasmaipada. So, and in Sanskrit, you really feel this. You really feel this when you read texts. And you have to take that into account. So what I'm calling Atmanipada Bhakti I'm sorry, Upmanapada Bhakti, is the first two of the four descriptions of Sringara in the Bhakti Sutra. Kanta Shakti, Asakti, that's right. Kanta Shakti, that is to say, the loving attachment and the intense loving desire for the beloved, Kanta. So, coming from the word come, the verb root come or kama, right, which involves intense desire, right, loving desire for the beloved. And then this is countered, there's a counterpart to this, in tanmayash sakti, the attachment, loving attachment, in feeling the possession of the beloved, maya, possessing that one, tan, tat, right?
One possesses the beloved, not the beloved possesses.
Right. Right, the possession of the... Right, it's not clear, I guess, from the English. Right, yes, that the bhakta possesses. Right. So, that's count... Those are sort of an interesting pair. That they desire the beloved... Yeah, they desire the beloved, and then they possess the beloved. Now compare that to Parasmaipada Bhakti. The offering of oneself to the beloved. Okay, so that's Parasmaipada. It's Paras, right? It's Parasmaipada. And then paramaviraha sakti, while wholly devoted to the beloved, feeling alone and far away. Now, I know that we all translate the word viraha as separation. Well, I'm tired of it. I'm here to tell you, I am sick and tired of that translation, Gavin. Because well, that's what I'm implying, but. I mean, use it in your textbook, and we all have used it. I've used it in my Princeton book. I mean, we all use it, okay? But I've decided no more. You know, it's like Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I am a user of Viraha translation, and I'm here to stop. Okay, I think that's the way to do it. I'm not sure, but anyway, I am a declared addict of the translation of Viraha. But viraha...
You're separating yourself from that translation.
Yes. Yeah. That hurts, Shanika. That hurts. I'm trying to get away from that word. Okay, so viraha, if you take the word apart, raha means secret. It means alone. It means by itself. And vi, far away. So I really feel it's very powerful. It's protractive a bit, but... feeling alone and far away from the beloved. Because if you recall, viraha is not only when the divine is in distance-wise far away, but in lilas, you can find the divine right there, and there can be viraha experience. Okay, so the feeling alone and far away, even in the presence of the beloved. So here, these are pairs. Offering oneself to the beloved precisely because they're feeling far away, alone and far away from the beloved. So these are pairs. So I call this Atmanapada Bhakti and Parasmaipada Bhakti. Terribly clumsy titles, but I thought it might be useful in identifying a certain dynamic within the deepest heart of bhakti. And it's there in the text. You have to go. Oh, you're missing my beautiful chart. That's terrible. Oh my gosh, you're missing all my pictures. Yes, but alone and far away. Yes, very good. Thank you for saying. Yeah. Oh, very good. That's very good. Yes, thank you for that. That's great. She did not say separated like you did. Okay, that's very much appreciated. Okay, and then just winding up here. Well, you know what? We have to wind up because it's already just about one, isn't it? What is it? Two. Yeah.
Three.
Let's just see if there's anything really... I said some of these things.
I thought we had till 3:30, but you don't.
Yeah, I think, to respect the timing, yeah. But why don't I just stop and just see if there are any particular things that we might mention. Any corrections, comments, criticisms, doubts... joys, effusive bhakti, whatever, appreciation.
Well,
So you finished the presentation now?
Yeah, I think I have to wind it. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, thanks,
that's
very interesting.
Yeah.
So, Pierre.
Yeah, thank you very much for the presentation. Actually, I haven't really spent much time on Bhakti Sutra, but just about the, I have a question about dating, because also for you too, because I just checked the Wikipedia and then the dating of Bhakti Sutra, and then according to Gavin Flood, it's still like the 12th century. So you must have written somewhere.
Yeah, it is in his intro. Yeah, I read it there. I check you out.
I'm just curious, what would be the sort of earliest available manuscripts on this sutra? Because that's how we can kind of get some idea about it. And I just think, because I'm doubtful about the 11th, 12th century dating, because just in terms of content, this idea of like this Braj and Gopikas, I mean, these things, I think it's usually later than 11th, 12th century. And I was just thinking, I'm kind of thinking about the dating of Gopāratapani Upanishad, which is also, it's kind of like, we don't really know the dating, but we don't really have anyone talking about it before Gaudiya's, like really before... like Rupa Jiva, we don't really have anyone talking about that name. And then there you see this, name Krishna, and Braja Gopikas and these things, Radhika. So, and then also I checked...
Wait, did you just say Radhika?
I think name Radhika is there in the, oh no, maybe it's not there.
Because see, that's one of the things that I've heard some scholars say, because the name Radha is not mentioned here. It must be before of course, this is pretty loose evidence, but it must be before the Gita Govinda. Or it must be around the same time.
No, actually, Gopāratapani Upanishad only says Gandharvika. That's the name of the sort of gopi.
Special gopi.
Yeah, special gopi.
Right.
And then the commentators, I think Jiva Goswami or Prabodhananda Saraswati, then identifies that Gandharvika with Radha. But in text itself doesn't have Radha or Radhika. But then I don't think it's earlier than Gita Govinda because of that idea, and also because of the... And then also just with this Bhakti Sutra, I mean, to be very honest, my feeling is it's even later than like 15th, 16th century because... I checked the e-text I have, and it doesn't say, like, Jiva Goswami doesn't say, like, it doesn't seem to mention this sutra.
No, it doesn't quote it.
So, so to me, the possibility is it's either very late text, or if it were early, it was not popular. And then I'm curious, like, what's your secret, and what's your view about the non-existence of commentary that you said you would discuss later.
Yeah. I said I would do it, and I didn't do it. But you're holding me to my word. I think Keo's point's very interesting, Gavin, because, it seems kind of like a fairly precocious text of the time. When you think about Ramanuja's Sri Bhashya, I mean, I just see nothing of Ramanuja, even in mood, or not that it would have to be. But, I mean, it just... And then I think of the next step of Madhva. And again, it seems terribly precocious. It does feel like a later text. It has the feeling of a later text. But saying that the name Radha surely would have been used when the Braja Gopikas were mentioned, I think is a very poor argument, because this text in general doesn't like proper names. Doesn't have proper names of the divinity. Why would it have a proper name of a gopi? So, it's very mysterious that way, and I think that arguments could be made in the direction that you're going in, as well as arguments could be made for about the 12th century. My feeling of why there are no commentaries for this text is, I don't think any sectarian Vaishnava text, and I think it moves more in the direction of Vaishnava text, even though Julius Lipner says there's something kind of universal, there's a universal feeling about this text that could apply to other traditions under the banner of Hinduism. I think it's because of its universal quality. I think it gets a little too universal, a little too unsectarian, that no tradition felt that comfortable claiming it. Mm-hmm. I think there are other texts around that they could claim better, including the Bhagavata, by the way, which clearly this is a servant of the Bhagavata, bringing up the Vrajagopikas. Mm-hmm. I think it wasn't attractive enough in promoting a particular sectarian, and I don't mean sectarian in a negative sense. I mean just identify particular. It's not a very doctrinally driven text. It's more trans-doctrinal, I think, and I think it seeks to do that.
So, and that's everyone takes ownership of it.
I think everyone sort of, they kind of looked at it and said, "Well, it's nice. That's really nice, but I don't. I need to promote more my doctrine than this universal stuff right now. I mean, we don't even have it together yet to really show our doctrine, our particular theology. So, I don't think it's that useful." Mm. Something like that. Because there is this universal feel, and it's no wonder that Westerners now are really focusing on the Bhakti Sutra.
Yeah.
People like the Bhakti Sutra in the West. It has a... and here this Catholic theologian... and scholar, Daniel Sheridan. Yeah. Didn't he go to Harvard also? I think he was educated. Maybe not.
He's well known there.
Yeah. Oh, maybe Fordham.
In spite of that.
Yeah. We're going to talk later. Okay. Anyway. Here's a Catholic,
sure,
who's taking to this text to look at Catholic mysticism in dialogue with the Bhakti Sutra.
Yeah, I mean, what about manuscript? Do we have any?
Okay, I have not done that. Hmm. All I tried to do was to find whether there are commentaries, and I figured I would find earlier manuscripts with that, but because nothing came up with that, I just sort of said, well, what the heck, pretty much the text that everyone's been using, there's very little discrepancy, but again, where do those texts come from is an excellent question.
Hmm.
So I don't know where it was written or anything like that.
I mean, it would be quite a job. You'd have to go to all the, older libraries of India and start digging around.
Yeah, I mean, well, just to check, like, Narada Bhakti Sutra and...
Categories.
And then, check, like... Just
but I think I checked that, and I couldn't find anything.
You didn't
No, I don't think I could find anything.
Okay.
But I'm not... Don't hold me to that. I believe I checked two other sources. And just the very fact I couldn't find anything here in Bodleian. I mean, there's something unsettling about it.
Yeah. Just for the argument's sake, if I say, I think this text sounds to me 17th century, and then what do you have any, some solid argument against that?
I would have something of an argument for it, but I think I would have an argument also against it. I would probably say that there's so little sign of doctrinal bhakti in here that it seems kind of raw. It seems like a raw text, and it seems that by the time Vallabha came along, and Jiva came along, Arupa came along, even Nimbarka. I mean, there's very little metaphysics in here. There's very little evidence that the author of this text really was exposed to doctrinal Vaishnavism. And so, for that reason, I would tend to place it early within the what we often call the Bhakti Renaissance. I don't even know if you like that term or not, but that's kind of why I would keep it around the 12th century, as you've put in your book, so we don't make it obsolete.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's the... what was his name? The
Viraha
Bhakti book?
Hardy. Right.
I mean, he did quite extensive research. Does he say anything? I was just...
No.
From Hardy,
yeah, that's probably... But that's about all he gives. I don't think he talks much about it. He brings it up, of course, because of the Viraha at the end. It's the 11th Asakti. So it helps with his work.
So does it influence the Chaitanya tradition, this text?
I can't find evidence of that. As I said to Shanika...
I don't think that the Goswami's quote...
No, I don't believe they do. I don't believe they do. And that does raise suspicion, because Jiva quotes from just about... Jiva quotes from Mary Had a Little Lamb. I mean, he quotes from everything. I mean, what doesn't Jiva quote from?
I mean, especially, he has Bhakti Sandarbha, which is like just dedicated on that topic. And if he does quote there, then I really feel that it's either later or...
Earlier, just ignored.
Yeah.
And I've been going with the latter.
Yeah, yeah.
So when did it get picked up then?
20th century.
Yeah, I see.
It really it's the first real serious commentary and edition is with the Ramakrishna Mission, Tyagishananda. You must have seen that. It's quite an interesting. I mean, the translation of the actual text itself is very eisegetical, interpretative, and so on. So you don't get a real accurate. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do it, to really get to the sense of what the text was doing. Do a bit of a textual analysis, which you see the beginnings of. And that's the other thing. I mean, it is a sutra text. The Chaitanya school and the Vallabha school, they didn't really write sutra texts. It was much more expositional. Verses were much more popular back then, writing in verse. Of course, writing a sutra text gives it a sense of antiquity and so on. So, I mean, you know, an authenticity and authority, which is one of the things I claim the text is making a case for. So anyway, you know, there are these different things. Nothing is inferential, you know. It's conjectural. Really, at best, it's conjectural. I take it more theologically, that this is kind of raw theologically, and that other schools came along and really built on it. And as you implied, the Chaitanya school, the Russes are incredibly, you know, adumbrated and very finely crafted. This is more like, you know, these 11 asaktis, you know, 11. 11? Like, what's 11? Why not 12? I mean, you know, it's... There's a kind of poignant roughness to this, and at the same time, a kind of sophistication. At the same time, and it's boggling. I mean, there's one text in here that says to describe. What do I? It says. Oh yeah, right here. Prema. To describe prema, it's described as anirvachaniya. So here's this important term from early Vedanta, anirvachaniya, right, from Shankara. I mean, that's a big word in Shankara. Yeah, he likes that word, because he doesn't want to describe the ultimate, because you gotta be it, know it. Let's not talk about it, but then he talks about it. Well, same thing here. To describe prema, it's anirvachaniya. It's like a mute trying to describe what is being tasted. Well, forget about being a mute. Even if you've never had an orange before, you know, and I'm tasting an orange and I'm trying to describe to you what an orange is, and I can speak, that's still impossible. But a mute trying to describe what I'm he's experiencing, forget it. I mean, you're that removed. But yet, then he goes on and describes what prema is in the text. So, I think that it's showing, to me, theologically. Struggles in the early theological formulations. That's what I'm focusing on. I found a use of a word parasparam for social bhakti. That word has a tiny little history. When A.K. Ramanujan came to, of course, I studied with him when I was in Chicago, but and then when I was at Harvard, he came and visited and lectured in John Carman's classroom, where I was at the time, and he made the case that in the Gita there is no social, there's no evidence of social bhakti. I'm thinking, okay. And then at the end he said, any questions, any comments? And I raised my hand. I said, Professor Ramanujan, hi again, and here we are again. I said, but what about that verse in the 10th chapter, the ninth verse? Machitta magata prana bodhayanta paraspara. Causing each other to be enlightened, causing one another to be enlightened. Isn't that social bhakti? Isn't there some sense of, And he thought for a second and said, I'll have to look at that. And so ever since then, I've made best friends with this verse. And the word parasparam is a very interesting one, and it's used in one of the sutra texts where it mirrors this whole verse, I feel. So, and there are a few other places where there's some mirroring going on. But it doesn't do a lot of reflecting of the Gita. There's some vocabulary that's kind of picked up. And also a little of the Bhagavata as well. But again, it has its own character. One of the things I found in this text is I want to go to this over here. Okay, and then I want to go to this over here. Oh yeah, okay, now, oh yeah, this is where I want to show you this. Why can't you see it? Let's see, I have to go like this. Okay. This is not where I want to take you exactly. My screen doesn't. Oh, that's only 10. Oh, okay. I want to go to. Okay. There is a text that is, in every translation I've ever read, is mistranslated. I wanted to see if I'm. I want you to tell me if I'm crazy, okay? I'm having trouble seeing on my screen. And then being able to get to it at the same time. Let me see here.
You want to reduce the size a little?
I don't know how to do that. Do you know how to do that? Okay, 20. Okay, I know basically where I am now. Let's just keep going here. Okay. Now I see by content where I am instead of looking at the numbers. Okay, here we go. Ah, okay. Here we go. Here it is. Here's the culprit. Satu karma jnana yoge bhyopi adhikatara. Okay, now, almost everyone translates this something like this. Bhakti, however, compared to action, knowledge, and yoga, is far more excellent. That's not correct. The dual case is used. Yogebhyaha. Karma jnana yogebhyaha. So we're talking about two entities. So what it's saying, it's not, yoga is bhakti, is rasa. It's not subsuming yoga. It's subsuming karma. The yoga, which is the perfection of karma and the perfection of jnana. That's what it's saying. Now please tell me I'm wrong.
It could be just practice, I guess.
Or practice, but take it literally. You just use the word yoga. It's just let others decide. But it's comparing two,
karma jnana.
But no one translates it that way. Nobody out of 10 translations. I begin to think like, I need to get checked out. Because is this there or is it not? And why am I the only one who sees this?
No, if you keep this up, you can be checked out of the middle.
Okay, Shanika?
Yeah. We should talk after this. Maybe you help me out that way.
It's a duel.
I mean, why? I mean, this is, again, we're not talking about, you know, meter issues. We're not talking about, I mean, it's there. I mean, my assumption is that the author knew better what he was doing than what we as translators think that he should be doing. So, what else am I to do with that? I don't understand it. They take it, and you know, the reason they do it, I know why they do that, because later traditions, like in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it will say something like that. It will list yoga as one of three things that are contained in bhakti. And this is one reason. Okay, Kyo. I think that this is an earlier text because it wasn't popular to subsume yoga at that point. It's closer to the Bhagavad Gita in that regard. Whereas later sectarian bhakti throws yoga in with karma and jnana. I feel this is it's a subtle but I think stronger point for an earlier dating. Which means that Gavin won't have to rewrite his book for another third edition. I mean, so I'm trying to save your publisher a lot of. Cambridge was your publisher, right? Yeah. So I'm trying to save, some. You know what I mean?
I'm just curious. In this translation, how would you render? Where is your rendering of api? Is it far or? I suppose far more excellent is just adhikarata. No?
Yeah, that's right. It's a comparative.
So api.
Api, right, far, right.
So yes. Api would be far.
Yeah. Api gives it that emphasis. That it's an emphatic. I take it as an emphatic here. Yeah.
Isn't that dative?
Dative. Sure. A dative or ablative? I believe. No, wait a minute.
Wait. Because duo would be like a biam, isn't
it?
It's
not duo.
Because duo is a biam, isn't it?
I'm really sorry. It's
dative.
Okay, it's dative.
Plural.
Plural? It's not dual?
No, it's not dual.
Because duo would be biam, no?
Yeah,
biam. Oh, maybe that's what I'm confusing. So it is plural. So I am crazy. Check me in. Check me in.
No, we just want to check you out.
Oh, yeah, check me. That's right. Just leave me there.
So it could be karma and jnana and yoga.
Well, that's the way everyone translates.
That must be.
And I was thinking.
And that's why.
Yeah.
That must be.
Okay. So it's not yoga byam,
no.
Right?
Yoga byam.
Yoga byam. So it is the three. Okay, well then I'd have to adjust my interpretation on the dating, which would be, you know, very possibly concurrent with Kyo's later dating and so on. Yeah. Yeah.
It's good job we discovered that, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
Anything else you want to run past?
No, this is good. This is good. We should do that. That's right. Yeah. Nothing like that.
So to me it's bhakti, however, is superior.
It's even more excellent. Even more excellent.
Yeah, even more excellent.
Even more excellent.
Don't you think, Kim?
Because, I mean, there's not really, like, compared in Sanskrit. So, I prefer like, something like bhakti, however, is superior even to karma, jnana.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's only the meaning is going to be the same.
Well, first of all,
it was more direct that way.
It's more direct that way.
And
then you use it for dative, though. I mean, why would it use the dative?
Oh, it's just comparison. So it's superior from.
Yeah, but why doesn't it use the ablative?
That's what reason I thought it was the ablative. I don't know why.
But I mean, dative and ablative are the same, right?
No, not.
Yeah. Can't.
Oh, I see. Oh, in form. Yeah.
Yeah, in form. Yeah, exactly. So, it is ablative and
it could be ablative.
It could be ablative.
Yeah, bhakti is superior.
And that's
wrong.
And that's why I took it as yeah, that's why I put the compared to there.
Yeah.
That's the from part. That's the ablative force.
Mm. Yeah.
So I knew it was ablative, but I didn't know it was not dual. I was on drugs that day, I think.
No, it happened.
Yeah, he knows because he drinks sake.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so, oh, I can't imagine what I would say this was if I was on sake.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, what's that? Oh dear.
We were at it.
I'm going to take these two machines. Yeah, that's right.
Well, thanks, Glenn. That's really interesting. We'll probably wind up now. But thank you so much for your presentation. It's very good that someone's kind of getting hold of this text and
trying to
sorting
work
it out.
Yeah, trying to sort it out. It's
because
it's enigmatic.
It's enigmatic.
It really is.
Yeah. Thanks so much. It's really interesting.
Delightful to be here. Yes. I'll stand up and bow. Such a formal. Yes.
Looking forward to its publication.
Yeah. So does the publisher. Yeah. I've been really hounded by them, but great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.
Yes, and thanks for this text correction. That'll be good.